Hey, Prime members, you can listen to Tides of History ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the app today.
The chariot rolled and bumped over the uneven ground. Its wheels squealed and thudded, spokes blurred as they turned and crushed the long stalks of grass underneath. The pair of horses slowed, breathing hard as the hill got steeper near the top. But the driver cracked the reins and pushed them onward. When the ground leveled out, the horses picked up the pace, and the vehicle hurtled toward the village's timber wall, which enclosed the motley collection of grass-roofed huts and the plumes of smoke waiting on top of the hill. The second man in the chariot didn't wait for it to come to a complete stop. He leapt out of the back, landing with a nimbleness born of long practice, and swaggered through the settlement's narrow gate. The sunlight, thin here in the foothills with the snow-capped peaks visible in the distance, glinted off his wealth of metal accoutrements. The gold loops hanging from his ears, the bronze crescent blade of the axe he held in his hands, and the two daggers in his belt, both of them with the delicate bronze figures and the shapes of horses projecting from their hilts. This village, his stride and bearing said, belonged to him. Another man, his face smudged with dirt, walked from one of the grass-roofed huts to meet the swaggering chieftain. He bowed his head and got a small nod in return, and then began to speak. The miner spoke of Issa, telling the chieftain how rich the veins were here and how much they had already pulled from the nearby mines. Tin was essential, half of what the miner called Issa Visca. Tin, Issa, and thus tin bronze, Issa Visca, would make the chieftain who controlled this place a rich and powerful man. Those weren't the chieftain's words. He spoke a different tongue, though he understood the miner perfectly well. Neither he nor the miner had been born anywhere close to this hill and the surrounding mountains, and the people who lived hereabouts spoke another language still. The chieftain didn't care what tongue they used, so long as they called him Asura, Lord. 4,000 years ago, the steppes of Central Asia were home to a revolution in transport technology, the invention of the chariot, and quite possibly horseback riding as well. People traveled incredible distances, brought together numerous cultures that had previously been widely separated, and made a new world whose legacy would last for millennia. At the heart of this newborn world were people who spoke a language we now call Indo-Iranian. I'm sure you've heard this from me before, but in case you haven't, I wrote a book. It's called The Verge: Reformation, Renaissance, and 40 Years That Shook the World. The Verge is out now, and you can order a hard copy, ebook, or audiobook from your distributor of choice. I'd really appreciate it. There's a link in this episode description that will take you there. Hi, everybody. From Wondery, welcome to another episode of Tides of History. I'm Patrick Wyman. Thanks for joining me. The Indo-Iranian languages are spoken across a huge swath of the globe today. Hindi, Urdu, Bengali, Punjabi, Farsi, Pashto, Kurdish, and the dozens of other languages belonging to this branch of the Indo-European family have more than 1.5 billion speakers, most of them in West, Central, and South Asia. In the past, the Indo-Iranian languages spread even further, from the Pannonian Basin of Central Europe to Siberia and the fringes of China. The Scythians of the classical world spoke Indo-Iranian languages. So did the Achaemenid Persians who fought the Greeks at Thermopylae, the Parthians who defeated Marcus Licinius Crassus, the wealthy merchants of the Silk Road, and the Mughal emperors. The Indo-Iranian languages and the people who spoke them have shaped the history of Eurasia and beyond for a very, very long time. But where did they emerge and how did they initially spread so far and wide? Can we peer back into the mists of time that preceded the use of written language and identify the groups of people who lay at the root of this long process of language expansion? Can we see them in the archaeological and genetic records, trace their movements over time, and understand the dynamics that powered those processes of migration and language change? I think we can, and in our next two episodes, we're going to give it a try. We'll focus first on the very beginnings of the Indo-Iranian language family, and then on the population movement that brought speakers of Indo-Aryan to South Asia, where they have remained for more than 3,000 years. This is a story about people moving over truly incredible distances, doing so quite quickly, making epic journeys that their ancestors could only have dreamed about. First, though, we need to start with some comments about methods, evidence, and categories of analysis. Languages themselves do not move. We cannot look at an artifact dug up from a 4,000-year-old archaeological site and say, ah, yes, this is an Indo-Iranian pottery sherd or bronze axe. Artifacts only indirectly carry ethnic identity, much less language. When we examine ancient DNA samples, they do not have a big glaring sign among all the A's, G's, C's, and T's that says, hey, I spoke an Indo-Iranian language. As we look for Proto-Indo-Iranian and its successors, we're actually looking for people. People who lived in a messy and complicated world. People make, acquire, and use artifacts. Sometimes those artifacts help to produce or affirm an identity, of which language might be a part. Or language might not signal anything at all about the objects one chooses to use or make. Languages might spread along with the expansion or movement of a particular genetic signal, like a Y chromosome or mitochondrial DNA haplogroup, or a chunk of whole genome ancestry. But population movements are not the only way in which languages spread. At most, we're looking for rough correlations between these various lines of evidence, linguistic, archaeological, and genetic, rather than perfect overlaps. The reason we need to be cautious is because of the really deeply flawed recent history of these concepts. About 100 years ago, the dominant way of looking at archaeology was called the culture historical model. This way of thinking equated an identifiable ethnic and linguistic identity with a defined archaeological culture that had artifacts, styles of house building, ways of burying their dead, and so on. With this model, the thinking was that you could trace the mass migration of coherent groups, often racial groups in the terminology of the time, by tracing the movement of particular kinds of artifacts. But this model has a couple of flaws. First, a lot of ethno-nationalist politicians, like the Nazis, used it to support racialized claims to territory. Because there had once been Germanic-speaking Goths in what's now Ukraine, for example, traced by archaeological excavations, it was therefore justifiable to get rid of the Ukrainians. Ethno-nationalist politicians still do this today, in a whole bunch of places around the world, by the way. Second, the culture historical model is at best a really limiting and more often a totally inaccurate way of understanding both population movements and identity, including how people choose and pass on their languages. It involves drastic oversimplifications of migration, the relationship between people and artifacts, and how artifacts come together to form something that we can identify as cultural traditions. Identity, according to the vast bulk of recent anthropological work, is not inherent to a person or a group. Instead, it's situational, produced by the circumstances in which we find ourselves. Different aspects of an individual's identity or identities become more or less important depending on the people around them, the situations in which they find themselves, and the groups with which they're in contact. For these reasons, migration as an explanation for changes in the historical and material record fell out of favor for a few decades. Migration has only become more popular again thanks to ancient DNA, which has pretty unequivocally shown that people have done a lot of moving around in the past. But ancient DNA has made it far too easy to fall back on that deeply flawed culture historical model, equating genes with an ethnic or linguistic identity and an archaeological culture. To be clear, these assumptions aren't limited to geneticists, they can also be found even in otherwise high-quality archaeological work. One recent and frankly essential work on the Indo-Iranians that's steeped in the Soviet archaeological tradition, for example, states it as an axiom that language and culture, even an archaeological culture, must go together. But things actually never, ever go together that neatly, even in the most clear-cut cases of mass migration that we find in the archaeological or historical record. People often speak two or more languages. They make choices about when to speak them based on factors that are hard for us to see in the archaeological record, and the items they use, things that they're buried with, may or may not have anything to do with those linguistic choices. Moreover, and more important in my opinion, is that at this point we should be trying to do more than establish the baseline fact that some people moved. We have the tools to understand population movements, language change, and the relationship between them in a much more granular, detailed, and informative way. We don't have to think of languages, cultures, or their speakers as blobs moving around a map because that's not how people actually move or live. So, with all that in mind, let's come back to the Indo-Iranians themselves. The first documented evidence of an Indo-Iranian language comes not from Central or South Asia, but from the Near East, from the Mitanni Kingdom of northern Syria and eastern Anatolia, which bordered the lands of the Hittites and Babylonians. the Mitanni Kingdom was mostly populated by Hurrian speakers. Hurrian is a non-Indo-European language, but the names of Mitanni kings are unmistakably of Indo-Iranian derivation. A treaty with the Hittite king Supililiuma, concluded in the 14th century BC, included oaths to the gods Indra, Varuna, and the Nasatya twins, all of which are familiar from other later Indo-Iranian texts. This time frame, the middle of the 2nd millennium BC, provides us with a handy anchor in time and space, a perfect terminus ante quem. By 1500 BC or thereabouts, certainly not later, the Indo-Iranian branch had noticeably diverged from Proto-Indo-European as a whole. Even more than that, Indo-Iranian had already separated into its two major branches, Iranian and Indo-Aryan, spoken now in South Asia. We know this because the Mitanni evidence seems to show features characteristics of this Indo-Aryan branch. So we know that speakers of one of these branches had already traveled a long distance from what we assume was their homeland, wherever that was, and Indo-Aryan names and deities were associated with Mitanni royalty. It's not a bad place for us to start. Indo-European experts generally argue that Proto-Indo-Iranian was one of the later branches to separate from the family as a whole. Anatolian, if you recall from our episodes on this topic, was the first. Tocharian was probably next, followed by the westward-moving branches that eventually became Celtic, Italic, Germanic, and so on. Proto-Indo-Iranian, by contrast, seems to have remained in contact with later splitting branches, especially Balto-Slavic. The key piece of evidence that points in this direction is called the Kentum-Satem distinction, based on the Proto-Indo-European word for hundred, Kumtum. This is a shorthand way of describing a fundamental sound change from Proto-Indo-European to its descendant branches. In some of these branches, like Italic, Celtic, and Greek, the sound K at the beginning of Kumtum remained in that form. Hence the word for hundred in Latin is Kentum, and it's Kantum in Proto-Celtic. But in Balto-Slavic, Indo-Iranian, and a few others, that K sound became S. So, hundred in Avestan, one of the earliest attested Indo-Iranian languages, is satem. It's satam in Sanskrit, it's shto in a few modern Slavic languages, and it's shimtas in Latvian. The shift to an S sound is more likely to be an aerial feature, something that spread among dialects that were in continued contact with one another, rather than a shared innovation among languages that split off from a common ancestor. But this too helps us narrow things down. Recent work on genetics and archaeology has made some pretty surprising arguments about the very early past of the Indo-Iranian branch. We talked in earlier episodes this season, back in June and July of 2021, about the corded ware culture and its descendants. This was a really quick-moving expansion of an archaeological culture that moved west out of the Eurasian steppes starting around 3000 BC. Within a couple of centuries, signs of this culture, mostly burials, had been established everywhere from the North Sea coast of the Low Countries through Scandinavia, the Baltic, and into the northwestern bit of Ukraine. People burying their dead in the fashion we associate with this culture, using the material items we associate with it, were almost certainly speakers of Proto-Indo-European. The easternmost branch of the late corded ware culture, called the Fatyanovo culture, was actually a product of a back migration from further west, along the Baltic and in Central Europe, back to the northern steppe. People associated with the Fatyanovo culture kept on moving east, across the forested woodlands, along the northern fringes of the steppe, through what's now European Russia, until they reached the eastern slopes of the Ural Mountains around 2100 BC. If we're looking for a context to explain the genetic and linguistic ties between Indo-Iranian and Balto-Slavic, they're probably a product of this particular era, especially the earlier part of it. We can trace this eastward migration through general similarities in material culture, but especially through genetics. According to a recent paper by the geneticist Leti Sag, all of the men associated with Fatyanovo graves and artifacts, literally all of them, belong to a single male lineage, the Y chromosome haplogroup R1A2Z93. This is important because R1A2Z93 is not the branch of R1A that's now common further to the west in Europe. Instead, we see R1A2Z93 at high proportions among speakers of Iranian languages in Central Asia and among Indo-Aryan speakers in South Asia. The Facinovo culture eventually blurred into what's known as the Abashevo culture, a much richer, more hierarchical, and violent world, and then around 2100 BC to the Sintashta culture in the eastern foothills of the Ural Mountains and the steppes of southern Russia and northern Kazakhstan. This was rich territory. It was home to huge copper mines, timber, fertile river valleys, and the valuable pastures at the northern edges of the steppe. The Sintashta culture is pretty striking. Fortified settlements with big walls, some of them surrounded by large earthen burial mounds packed with copious amounts of grave goods and evidence of lavish funeral celebrations, formed the core points of the Sintashta world. Based on the evidence we see in the archaeological remains, the Sintashta culture looks like one ruled by a male-dominated and warlike aristocracy that sat at the top of a defined social hierarchy. A group like that, with strong competition for the best settlement locations, pastures, and control of trade, especially in metals, would produce both conflict and incentives to go outward. When combined with a major technological innovation in the form of the chariot, evidence for which first appears in Sintashta sites, the path to a massive expansion seems clear. Archaeologists have drawn connections between the Sintashta culture and the world of the Proto-Indo-Iranians for quite some time, often going so far as to call Sintashta the material manifestation of the Proto-Indo-Iranian speech community. We talked before about how equating these things does a really poor job of capturing how people actually live in the world. Genetic populations, material culture areas and networks, and speech communities overlap in some way, often quite significantly, but simply calling that good enough misses the interesting parts of actual life. The Sintashta world and the descendant groups to which it contributed was much messier and more fascinating than this simple equation implies.
If you travel, you know when it comes to love.
See you soon.
Can't wait.
The sky is no limit. You know with your Delta Amex card, being oceans apart means meeting in Aruba. And booking a war travel with your card means saving 15% on Delta flights. You know kissing under the bridge of sighs guarantees eternal love. Because you're the long-distance lovebirds. It's why you're a Delta SkyMiles Platinum American Express card member. If you travel, you know. Takeoff 15 discount not applicable to partner-operated flights or taxes and fees. Terms apply. Visit go.amex/you know.
If I asked you how many subscriptions you have, would you be able to list all of them and how much you're paying? If you would have asked me this question before I started using Rocket Money, I would have said yes. But let me tell you, I would have been so wrong. I can't believe how many I had and all the money I was wasting. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/Wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/Wondery. rocketmoney.com/Wondery.
You see, when we talk about Sintashta, or its descendants, Petrovka and especially Andronovo, as Indo-Iranian, we obscure some really important and fundamental things about them and the people who lived in them. This was, first and foremost, a multicultural and multilingual world. The people who lived in settlements we call Sintashta, and who probably did speak Proto-Indo-Iranian, were not alone in that part of the Urals and the neighboring steppe. Speakers of other Indo-European varieties and dialects lived to their west in the Pontic-Caspian steppe and the forests of European Russia to their north. To the east in Siberia lived a whole array of groups of foragers who probably spoke languages ancestral to some of the many varieties that are still present in Northeast Asia today. To the south were the cities of the Bactria-Margiana archaeological complex, also known as the Oxus civilization, where people farmed, traded, and spoke an unidentified but definitely non-Indo-European language. And in the immediate vicinity of the Sintashta people were speakers of another proto-language that would go on to leave many descendants, everywhere from Siberia to northern Europe. That language was Proto-Uralic, which eventually gave rise to Finnish, Estonian, Hungarian, Sami, and many others. It's these latter two groups, the Oxus civilization and the Proto-Uralic folks, that I want to focus on here. So in fact, this was a world defined by contact between different groups and the movement of ideas and people between them. Sometimes those contacts were violent, involving conquest, war, raiding, and control. But there was also intermarriage, alliance, peaceful migration, and above all, trade. There is no reason to assume that all interactions between different groups were zero-sum in nature, that somebody had to win and somebody had to lose. Different groups occupying different ecological niches, producing different raw materials and finished goods, keeping different kinds of animals and raising different crops might actually complement one another quite nicely. That's the context in which we have to understand the formation and expansion of Indo-Iranian, not one of a self-contained, hermetically sealed, linguistic, cultural, genetic group that we call the Indo-Iranians. Moreover, it's highly likely that these Indo-Iranians, to the extent that they existed as an identifiable group, weren't united, but instead competed with one another. We shouldn't assume that they were all on the same side, bound together by language, kinship, or ethnic identity. Very much the opposite. The Sintashta culture seems to have been defined by powerful leaders who occupied fortified sites, fought in chariots, and built huge burial mounds when they died. That kind of worldview is aimed at impressing one's peers, people who can understand the visual language at play. And those peers were presumably other Sintashta chieftains, not outsiders who never would have seen their fortified settlements or their burial mounds. There's no reason to think that a Sintashta chieftain would have preferred to ally with his neighboring Indo-Iranian-speaking chieftain, or seen himself as having more in common with him, than with a Uralic-speaking headman who could provide copper ore, or an Oxus bigwig who controlled a walled town. Let's focus for a moment on the Uralic speakers. As a note here, I'm drawing on the Finnish Indologist Asko Parpola's book, The Roots of Hinduism. So the original homeland of the people who spoke Proto-Uralic, the language ancestral to the many later Uralic languages, was somewhere in the vicinity of the Ural Mountains, hence the name Uralic. The internal evidence of Proto-Uralic suggests that its speakers were fishermen, hunters, and foragers, presumably living in the mountains, forests, and the broken forest steppes to the north of the grasslands proper. No native words for agriculture exist, they're all later loanwords. There are enough loanwords and correspondences between Proto-Indo-European and Proto-Uralic to suggest that the two languages were vaguely in contact with one another, probably before 3000 BC, but there are far more between Indo-Iranian and Proto-Uralic. These terms cover a whole variety of topics, which indicates extensive interchange. Proto-Indo-Aryan Vajra, weapon of the war god, becomes Proto-West Uralic Vasara, hammer or axe. There are a bunch related to metals and metal items, others that have to do with religion, some for terms about trade, value, and price, and still others that have to do with hierarchy and leadership. Proto-Indo-Aryan Asura, meaning lord, becomes Proto-Uralic Asera, or Asira. The easiest explanation for this is to be found in the context of the Sintashta culture and its surroundings. We know that metalworking was a big deal in Sintashta settlements. There are furnaces, forges, piles of leftover slag, tons of evidence for relatively large-scale manufacturing of finished metal goods. Not all of these items stayed in Sintashta settlements. Some of them traveled quite far afield, carried by what archaeologists call the Sejma Turbino Network. The characteristic items of this network were metal weapons, especially decorated knives and maces. The decorations, not coincidentally, were most often related to horses. These weapons can be found spread over huge distances, everywhere from Finland and the Baltic to Siberia and Central Asia, and they're most heavily concentrated right around the Urals. But what's fascinating about the Sejma Turbino network, why it's a network and not an archaeological culture, is that it crosses the boundaries of individual archaeological cultures. Its items have been found in Sintashta territory, on Sintashta sites. They've been found east of there, among the presumably Uralic speakers of what's called the Cherkaskul culture, and well to the west in the lands of the Srubnaya culture in the western steppe and beyond. Now, Proto-Uralic had native terms for metals. Tin is Esa. Esa Veska means tin bronze, and so on. Now, it's probably not a coincidence that Sejma Turbino items extend across a broad swath of the region that would, in the future, be inhabited by Uralic-speaking peoples. We might see the Sintashta settlements, with their Indo-Iranian-speaking chariot warrior elite, as the heart of this new world of large-scale metalworking, but it's a safe bet that some of the people living in Sintashta settlements had grown up speaking Uralic, in settlements scattered along the forested rivers to the north. It's likely that the traders who carried Sejma Turbino-type weapons over those vast distances spoke Uralic, either as a primary or secondary language. And it's really hard to imagine, given the fact that proto-Uralic speakers had their own words for metals, that Tsimtashta people were the only ones mining ore or working metals in the lands around the Ural Mountains. The ancient DNA evidence suggests a significant amount of population mixture right around this time. A massive study led by Vagish Narasimhan and Nick Patterson in 2019 broke down in extensive detail the populations across Central and South Asia in the ancient world. They established beyond doubt that there had been migrations from the steppe into Central and especially South Asia, and it's not hard to associate those migrations with the spread of Indo-Iranian languages. But this wasn't as simple as a pure group of steppe pastoralists migrating south. About 9% of that steppe ancestry that would eventually end up in Central and South Asia was derived from a group Narasimhan and his colleagues refer to as West Siberian hunter-gatherer, right around this time, about 2000 BC and a bit before. Now, the most plausible candidate for that ancestry is the Uralic-speaking foragers who lived around the Urals, with whom the Tsimtashta people were in close contact. The Tsimtashta Cemetery at Kamenyi Anbar, near the Russia-Kazakhstan border in the southern Urals, had a whole group of genetic outliers, people who were different from most of the folks buried there, who had a great deal more ancestry from this West Siberian hunter-gatherer group. So we can actually see this process of mixing taking place in real time. Now, this is the core point. I think it's pretty safe to say, based on ancient DNA and parallels between the Indo-Iranian linguistic evidence and the archaeology, that Tsimtashta and Indo-Iranian go together. But that doesn't mean they were the only ones living in this world, that they were the only ones who mattered, that they were the only ones who had agency while other people and groups were simply tossed around like flotsam on the waves. Why assume that those Tsimtashta settlements were somehow hermetically sealed laboratories for producing a people, slash culture, slash language, slash ethnic group that was designed to expand so far? As we discussed earlier, we can trace a genetic signature and probably a language backward from Tsimtashta to Facinovo to Corduedware, but at every point, those people were in contact with other groups, some of whom spoke other Indo-European dialects and others who didn't. The Facinovo people, for example, hadn't built big burial mounds. The Tsimtashta chieftains probably got that practice from other groups living on the steppe who had retained it from the Yamnaya period. That process of contact, which profoundly shaped the Indo-Iranians who eventually spread out so far, didn't stop. Assuming the horse-drawn chariot was in fact a Tsimtashta innovation, it didn't stay in its homeland near the Urals for very long. Within just a couple of centuries, there were chariots everywhere from Mycenaean Greece to Afghanistan, from the Atlantic to China a few centuries after that. By the standards of archaeological cultures, the Tsimtashta complex didn't actually last very long. At the most, just a few centuries, from perhaps 2200 BC at the very earliest to 1800 BC at the very latest. But it's a bit more complicated than that because there are issues of terminology and classification here. There is no obvious dividing line between the Tsimtashta culture and what came afterward. What's clear is that beginning during the Tsimtashta heyday, and definitely by 1800 BC, there was a significant expansion out of that Tsimtashta heartland to the south and the east. A new cultural complex emerged, one that in the very broadest definition would stretch from the steppes just north of the Black Sea, all the way to the Altai Mountains and even Xinjiang in western China. This is broadly known as the Andronovo culture, and much more than Tsimtashta, it's generally agreed to be a material expression of a group that spoke Indo-Iranian. The primary reason for this is that Andronovo is the direct ancestor of archaeological cultures that are directly associated by historical texts with later Iranian-speaking groups. As far as these murky, arguable associations in the distant past go, it's as close to an open and shut case as we're going to find. The people of the Andronovo culture were Indo-Iranians, some of them sedentary villagers and even farmers, but most of them pastoralists who had horses, flocks of sheep, and herds of cattle and camels who moved from place to place out on the steppe. They built large burial mounds, kurgans, for their honored elite dead. Weapons were common and war was not unfamiliar. Chariots took them from place to place, and the oldest solid evidence for riding on horseback comes from sites that fall under that broad Andronovo cultural umbrella. They were the forerunners of the well-known Scythians of antiquity in every way. The Tsimtashta connection is clear. Northwestern Andronovo and Tsimtashta ancient DNA samples are indistinguishable. For that matter, Andronovo samples also overlap with those of neighboring groups on the steppe to the west, which we'll talk about more later. The cultural ties are likewise obvious. Kurgan burials, chariots, some fortified settlements, pastoralism both mobile and sedentary, and so on. But again, this is where it gets tricky. The Andronovo culture is not a single entity. It's at least a few groupings, some of them quite different from one another, that aren't always sharply differentiated from supposedly different groups also living on the steppe. In the West, for example, the Andronovo culture bleeds into the contemporary Srubnaya culture on the steppes north of the Black Sea. In the East, the Fedorovo variant of Andronovo overlaps with the earlier Alakul, which overlaps with Sintashta, and so on. Now, this is true of pretty much all archaeological cultures. That's because they're an analytical tool, not an objective expression of reality, but it's especially obvious in this case. The attempts to separate out these various cultures just shows how artificial the whole endeavor really is. We're talking about people, people who were in contact with one another, who talked to each other, who learned from one another, exchanged or took items and ways of manufacturing them. Even ancient DNA, as useful as it is for informing us about an individual's ancestry, can't tell us whether somebody was bilingual or multilingual. It can't tell us how far a person had traveled during their lifetime, about their fondness for a particular food, tasted on a trading trip in their youth, about their unlikely friendship with a person from a distant group, about their fumbling attempts to learn a new language to impress a potential romantic partner. So the Andronovo culture is broadly associated with Indo-Iranian. Is that really the key thing about it that matters? I don't think so. The people who lived at sites that we call Andronovo, who spoke a language we call Indo-Iranian, were part of a much bigger world. They were in contact with people both like and unlike themselves in a whole variety of ways. And from my perspective, those connections, which determined the eventual path of Indo-Iranian expansion, are just as important as the initial genesis of the group, wherever and whenever that happened.
If you travel, you know how to pull off a perfect getaway. You know after you enroll with your Delta SkyMiles Platinum American Express card, you get up to $10 back monthly on U.S. rideshare purchases with select providers, like a car to the airport. You know which remote retreats have the best herbal baths and where the Wi-Fi password is rarely used. Because you're the escape artist. It's why you're a Delta SkyMiles Platinum American Express card member. If you travel, you know. Terms apply. Purchases must be on card. Visit go.amex/you know.
Now, this is where things start to get a little blurrier. To recap, there's no real doubt that there were Indo-Iranian-speaking groups established in the vicinity of the Urals and the nearby steppes by no later than 2000 BC. We know that these people expanded outward, and that some of them eventually ended up in South Asia, on the Iranian plateau, as far west as Hungary, and as far east as Siberia and Xinjiang. None of that's in question. What's harder to figure out is when that happened and how. It was a long way from the steppes of northern Kazakhstan to South Asia, where we find the early Sanskrit texts of the Rig Veda, and to Mesopotamia, where we first see written evidence of an Indo-Iranian language with the Mitanni Kingdom. The spaces in between, the southern steppes of Central Asia, the mountains of Afghanistan, the Iranian highlands, and the peaks of the Hindu Kush, weren't empty either. There were other people living there. So how did speakers of Indo-Iranian get there? By what routes and what dynamics drove their movements? Were they refugees from a changing climate, conquering warriors, hired mercenaries, whole tribal groups seeking out new lives after a defeat, something else entirely? To answer those questions, we can't think about Indo-Iranians, whatever they were, in isolation. They were, like their predecessors of the Sintashta culture, part of a broader world, or rather a broader series of worlds. There are two core questions we have to address. First, when and where did the fundamental split in the Indo-Iranian language family, the division between the Iranian and Indo-Aryan branches, take place? This is connected to the second question. What was the relationship between speakers of Indo-Iranian, the sophisticated urbanized world of the Oxus civilization in today's Turkmenistan, and the movements of Indo-Iranian speakers beyond the steppe? Let's start with the first question, about the division between Iranian and Indo-Aryan. The Indo-Aryan branch is attested earlier in the scattered references from the Mitanni Kingdom after about 1500 BC, and then very shortly afterward in the oldest layers of the Sanskrit texts in the Rig Veda. Today, the Indo-Aryan branch is what's spoken in South Asia, including languages like Hindi, Bengali, Punjabi, and the ancestral Sanskrit, while Iranian includes everything from Farsi, Kurdish, and Pashto to the tongues of the ancient Scythians. Iranian is first attested in the Avesta, the oldest religious texts associated with Zoroastrianism, which were first composed around 1000 BC. Only a few centuries separate the first texts in Sanskrit from those in Avestan, and they're close enough to one another that the divergence between their parent languages can't have been too far in the distant past. This gives us a time frame of 1500 BC, or probably a bit earlier for the divergence, but not too much earlier. Beyond that, we're left to speculate. Scholars have advanced a whole array of arguments about the split into Indo-Aryan and Iranian. Some place the division even before the emergence of the Sintashta culture by 2200 BC or so. In this reading, Sintashta wouldn't be Indo-Iranian, but specifically Indo-Aryan, while the neighboring catacomb culture of the Western Steppe would be Iranian. That seems really early, though, considering how close Avestan and Sanskrit still were around 1000 BC. The genetic evidence would seem to argue against this early split as well, given the similarity of Andranovo and Sintashta ancient DNA samples. So we should probably look a bit later at the Andranovo culture, its subdivisions, and its successors. As I mentioned a little earlier, what we call the Andranovo culture is actually several distinct but related archaeological groupings, the two most important of which are Alakul and Fedorovo. Alakul is the more western of the two, occupying part of what's now Kazakhstan, while Fedorovo was the eastern branch, extending into southern Siberia. It's possible that the division between the branches has something to do with this split, but that's unclear. Now, neither of these two Andranovo groupings, like their Sintashta predecessors, was alone in the steppe or the broader world of Central Asia. To their south, living along the fertile riverbanks of what's now southern Turkmenistan, was a sophisticated and already old urban society. The Bactria-Margiana archaeological complex, also known as the Oxus civilization. The Oxus civilization had grown rich and well-connected beginning between 2400 and 2200 BC, probably as a major supplier of copper and especially tin for the voracious consumers of the Iranian plateau and Mesopotamia beyond. This was a rich world of fortified towns and cities, merchants and rulers, temples, and rich burials. The Oxus civilization is little known today. It was only discovered, excavated, and published starting in the 1960s by Soviet archaeologists, but it was a key cog in the interconnected world of the early and middle Bronze Age. Untangling the relationship between Indo-Iranian as a whole, the Indo-Aryan branch, and its eventual southward migration specifically, and the Oxus civilization is a confusing and difficult task. Scholarly opinions abound, but convincing arguments are thinner on the ground. One older and much repeated line held that the Oxus civilization was, in fact, Indo-Iranian. We can categorically say now that this was not the case. The Oxus civilization grew out of local roots in southern Turkmenistan, northern Afghanistan, and northeastern Iran, roots that had been in place through the preceding Chalcolithic and Neolithic. Ancient DNA studies of individuals buried in Oxus civilization cemeteries have shown that their ancestry ties them not to the Yamnaya or the steppe, but to the first farmers of the eastern part of the Fertile Crescent. These Iranian farmers migrated east thousands of years before the Oxus civilization came into existence. That specific ancestry remained in place throughout all of those thousands of years, mixing along the way with the local hunter-gatherers who had previously lived in the region. The Oxus civilization was a fundamentally local development. But that does not mean that the Oxus civilization had absolutely nothing to do with Indo-Iranians. That monumental 2019 ancient DNA study showed that the steppe ancestry that eventually made its way to South Asia, the Indo-Aryan migration, also came with a bit of ancestry characteristic of the Oxus civilization. Moreover, the Proto-Indo-Aryan language was full of loanwords from a non-Indo-European language. The linguist Alexander Lubotsky counted at least 383 non-Indo-European words in Vedic Sanskrit. 55 of them were borrowed into common Proto-Indo-Iranian, but Proto-Indo-Aryan had another and much more intense layer of later borrowings as well. These two layers of borrowings came from the same non-Indo-European language. The best explanation for this is that both the speakers of Proto-Indo-Iranian and the slightly later speakers of Proto-Indo-Aryan were in contact with the same group, the latter much more intensely than the former. Lubotsky points out that the earlier layer of borrowings, those into Proto-Indo-Iranian, were largely connected to agriculture. Words for bread, plowshare, canal, brick, camel, ass, and a few items related to religion. who were settled agriculturalists with camels, bread, plowshares, asses, and structures made of bricks living in close proximity to the Sintashta and Andronovo cultures. The people of the Oxus civilization, of course. And in fact, they're the only real candidates. So how should we understand the relationship between these groups? Was it trade, conflict, intermingling, or something else? The archaeological evidence contains some revealing clues. One of the fascinating things about the Oxus civilization is that its most dynamic urban phase, from 2200 BC to 1800 BC, coincided with intense contact with mobile pastoralists. In fact, the urban settlements of the Oxus civilization were surrounded by the encampments of people who moved around, taking their livestock from pasture to pasture within the vast area of the Morgab Delta of southern Turkmenistan. Now, some of that land there was suitable for farming, which the people of the Oxus civilization exploited intensively. But some of it wasn't suitable for farming, since it was too dry. We're talking about the deserts of southern Turkmenistan. But that was still good pasture for sheep, cattle, and horses. Pastoralists lived in these in-between spaces. They pitched their tents and lived with their herds in close proximity to groups of settled agriculturalists and even cities. Far from being in conflict, these groups complemented one another. They traded goods back and forth, not just luxuries, but even everyday items, in something like a symbiotic relationship. It is not hard to imagine that these pastoralists would have spoken an Indo-Iranian language. There's no guarantee of this, of course, but it would seem to fit the genetic, linguistic, and archaeological evidence. If this is the case, rather than a straight southward move from the land around the Urals, where the Sintashta fortified settlements were located, to Turkmenistan and the Oxus civilization, the route was probably more circuitous. The lands surrounding the Aral Sea in southern Kazakhstan and northern Turkmenistan are extremely arid. In fact, they're deserts. If you're a pastoralist with flocks to move, that is not exactly welcoming territory. If you go east, however, toward Lake Balkhash and the Altai Mountains beyond, there's still pasture. This is the eastern entrance to what's known as the Inner Asia Mountain Corridor. It's a narrow band of traversable territory that flanks the Tian Shan, Dzungar, and Pamir Mountains. This route isn't easy, but it leads east to Xinjiang and China beyond, and west through Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan, Uzbekistan, and Tajikistan into Turkmenistan. From a very early date, it seems that steppe people with Sintashta connections made their way south and east to this corridor, then followed it back to the west to the Oxus civilization. Traffic would have moved in a semicircular fashion, clockwise from the Urals to the corridor to the Oxus settlements, then counterclockwise back. Archaeological sites attest to this movement. One very early grave in this corridor, dated to around 2000 BC and found near the city of Sarazm in Tajikistan, contains an amalgam of Oxus and steppe artifacts. The owner was a high-status man, and he was buried with a slaughtered ram, three Oxus-style pottery vessels, an Oxus bronze vessel, a steppe-style gold earring, weapons with horse hilts like those of the Sejma Turbino network, and most telling of all, two full sets of Sintashta horse tack. This was the equipment of a Sintashta chariot-riding chieftain who had traveled far and wide from his home, someone plugged into the various networks and trade routes that defined the steppe at this specific, dynamic moment. If we are looking for the kind of person who might have spoken very early Indo-Aryan, right around the time of the split from Indo-Iranian, this man would be a perfect candidate. And at roughly the same time, this man was buried, perhaps a bit earlier, the first finds of domestic horses show up in and around the Oxus civilization. In return, we see Oxus pottery, or at least pottery made in imitation of Oxus styles, in occupation layers in Sintashta or Andronovo sites in northern Kazakhstan. The outlines of what happened seem fairly clear. Pastoralists with connections to the Sintashta fortified settlements around the Urals moved southeast, then back to the west, coming into contact with the people of the Oxus civilization. Those contacts continued for some time, leaving a significant mark in Proto-Indo-Iranian in the form of those loanwords for key agricultural and religious concepts. Later, a splinter group of Indo-Iranians came still closer to the Oxus civilization, probably living among them, inaugurating a much more intense phase of cultural contact that we see in those additional loanwords. These would have been the ancestors of the Indo-Aryans who eventually went west to Mitanni and south to South Asia. Those were precisely the pastoralists living among the cities of the Oxus civilization. Now, some scholars have argued that around 2000 BC, or perhaps a bit later, the Oxus civilization was actually conquered, or at the very least taken over, by an Indo-Aryan-speaking elite group. According to this interpretation, this led not to the downfall of the Oxus civilization, but to its expansion. New Oxus settlements, trade goods, and practices showed up a long way from southern Turkmenistan, as far south as Baluchistan and present-day southern Pakistan. This is possible, but in my opinion, the evidence for it's pretty thin. That's because the Oxus civilization was defined by its long-distance connections from its very beginning. We don't have to invoke a takeover by Indo-Aryan speakers to explain it. I think a better conception of what happened would be that those Indo-Aryan-speaking pastoralists living around the cities of the Oxus civilization simply followed the trade routes outwards. One group followed them west, eventually reaching Syria and becoming the elite of the Mitanni kingdom with their Indo-Aryan gods and specialized vocabulary for chariot warfare. Another group followed them south, leaving a much longer-lasting legacy in South Asia. In this reasoning, other related groups, the widespread people of the Andranovo culture and the related Srubnaya culture further west, would be the forerunners of the later Iranian speakers. Some of them would come south a bit later, into the mountains and deserts of Central Asia. At least a few of these Iranian-speaking groups established themselves in the abandoned ruins of the cities of the Oxus civilization. Others went west and south again into the Iranian plateau. These would be the ancestors of the Medes and Persians, who left such an enormous mark on history. As we conclude here, I want to come back to some of the concepts I mentioned earlier. When we search for the deep past of the Indo-Iranians, we can't simply backtrack, sniffing like a bloodhound for a trail. Well, we can't, but I'm not sure how far that gets us. We have all these amazing tools, like historical linguistics, ancient DNA, traditional archaeology, and archaeological sciences. When we put those together, we end up with a far messier but much more realistic version of the past. In this version, the Indo-Iranians emerged in a situation of intense cultural contact with other groups, initially Uralic speakers and then the people of the Oxus civilization. We have to understand the emergence and expansion of Indo-Iranian speakers as a product of that broader world. Without Uralic-speaking miners and traders, would Sintashta settlements have grown so prosperous from metalworking? Without the urban settlements and trade routes of the Oxus civilization, would Indo-Aryans and later Indo-Iranians ever have spread so far? I highly doubt it. The most plausible interpretation of this expansion, in my view, is that it was a product of a world that was already pretty connected. But the characteristic technological innovation of the Proto-Indo-Iranians, the chariot and perhaps horseback riding, served as a multiplier effect on that already connected world. People could move further, carry more goods, absorb more words and ideas, carry news of distant opportunities back home faster. The prototypical Sintashta site of Arkaim is 1,000 miles, 1,600 kilometers, from where that rich charioteer was buried in Tajikistan. That's 1,000 miles as the crow flies. The actual distance was even further. It's 300 miles, 500 kilometers from that site in Tajikistan to the Oxus settlement at Gonurdepe. Just think about those distances for a moment. We have to understand the emergence of Indo-Iranian and its sub-branches as a product of a world in which that kind of movement wasn't just possible, but a fairly regular occurrence. And that is absolutely remarkable. Next time on Tides of History, we'll follow one branch of the Indo-Iranian language family, the Indo-Aryan branch, a bit further. Indo-Aryan languages are spoken by hundreds of millions of people in South Asia today, but how did they get there? When? And why? That's what we'll discuss next week.
Hey, Prime members, you can listen to Tides of History ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the app today. Or you can listen ad-free with Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts. Before you go, tell us about yourself by completing a short survey at wondery.com/survey.
I've also written a book called The Verge, Reformation, Renaissance, and 40 Years That Shook the World. It's available now on hard copy, ebook, or audiobook that I read, of course, from your distributor of choice. There's a link in this episode description that will take you there. Tides of History is written and narrated by me, Patrick Wyman. Sound design by Molly Bach for Airship. The sound engineer is Sergio Enriquez. Tides of History is produced by Morgan Jaffe. From Wondery, the executive producers are Jenny Lower-Beckman and Marshall Louie. Thanks again for listening. Until next time, from Wondery, this has been Tides of History.
how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.